Hello, I'm Andy Burnham, and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. And this week, we review the first edition of The Wave, a new underground radio magazine. Details of a new space mission to probe Venus, and listen to a new FM pirate that isn't a pirate. Goings on in the AM band in the London area. Fed up with the back teeth with the neighbours, eh? Well, why not fit some DIY sound insulation? An extract and review of the new radio tape from the Radio Broadcast Library. And the government continue to pile the pressure on the BBC. Which services will be squeezed out? And finally, consumers speak out about outrageous prices for compact discs. That's the lineup for this week. Some other small snippets and, as always, your letters. It's 6205, 12255 and 3910. That's Radio Facts. And every Monday and Tuesday, Sparks, the weekly programme of science, media and technology news. Fun, fun, fun. Fun, fun, fun. Fun, fun, fun. Fun, fun, fun.
James Dean posters on their wall. What sad little end to it all. Last seen having lots of fun. Put them on the run. I am mad from Scandinavia. I want a guy in the London area. We must be crazy and Sagittarius. Cause I am Leo and I'm hilarious. Which gives me fun, fun, fun. A journey fun.
A couple of weeks ago, the BBC TV programme Sky at Night was 35 years old. And here from their anniversary programme, Patrick Moore looks at the latest in space research.
The first planet to be contacted by a space probe was Venus, way back in 1962 with Mariner 2. And Mariner 2, like all the later American planetary probes, was controlled and monitored from the JPL, or Jet Propulsion Laboratory, at Pasadena in California. And the nerve center is the DSN, or Deep Space Network. And this is an incredible place. It's pure equator mass. It's here that the signals from the probes are being received, and it's here the commands are sent out to them. And remember, the DSN had been in action 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, for over 30 years now. So what have we learned? Venus first. Well, Venus didn't turn out to be the kind of world we expected. We'd expected to find a good deal of water there. Well, we didn't. What we found was a very hot world indeed, with a temperature not far short of 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, with a choking atmosphere made of carbon dioxide and clouds made of sulfuric acid. We've learned more since then, The mariners and, of course, the Russian Veneras, some of which made soft landings there, have told us a great deal. But the latest probe, Magellan, should improve on any of these. It's not going to land on Venus. It's going round and round the planet, and it's mapping the surface by radar in more detail than had ever been possible before, and should tell us what Venus as a world is really like.
Well, Magellan is a spacecraft that was launched by NASA on May 4th of 1989, and we arrived at Venus on August 10th of 1990. The spacecraft has one major instrument on board, and that is the radar. You can see this large dish antenna at the top of the spacecraft, and that's the antenna that we use to send radar waves down to the planet's surface. They're reflected back, and from those reflections, we turn those into images. We can't use a conventional camera to image the surface of Venus because you'd get basically pictures of clouds. Venus is covered by a greenhouse effect, so that you need a radar to penetrate those clouds and produce an image of the surface. We also have an altimeter on board which measures the surface height and allows us to build up a topographic map of the surface.
What's the main point of going to Venus?
Well, Venus is known among scientists as the most Earth-like of the terrestrial planets. And that's because the two planets have about the same mass and about the same density. We think they're composed of about the same material. Now that's important because we think that the size of a planet and what it's made out of have a lot to do with the sort of geologic activity that you see on the planet. Namely, the larger a planet is, the more heat it produces, and heat is what drives geologic processes. So therefore, the geology of the Earth and the geology of Venus might be very similar, allowing us to learn a lot more about the Earth.
What are the main results so far?
We've found many interesting things, many interesting volcanic features. For instance, we found channels that seem to have been thermally eroded, or where the heat of the lava actually cuts down and erodes a channel into the surface. We recently found one of these channels that's about 7,000 kilometers long. These are very unusual features that imply some really unusual compositions and styles of eruption that we don't really understand, so that's been very exciting. We've seen very unusual tectonic features, large rift zones where the crust of the planet seems to be pulling apart, large mountain ranges over 11 kilometers above the surface of the planet. We've seen just so much tectonic activity and so much volcanic activity that we're really still struggling to figure out how this planet works and how it compares to the Earth.
Wall up your neighbours. In the Daily Telegraph by Jonathan Futrell. Obliterating the sound of noisy neighbours used to be comparatively simple. If diplomacy and blind aggression failed, we could contact the local estate agent, sell up, and go. In the present economic climate, this is nigh on impossible, which is why many of us must look for a more inventive solution. My own problem was typical of many. I lived on the ground floor, and access to the upstairs flat was via a newly installed staircase in a reduced width hall behind a hollow stud wall. It meant that every time Rupert and Amanda returned from hunting, shooting, fishing, or wine tasting, my wife and I could count the steps until they collapsed at the top of the stairs, with just enough strength left to switch on their favourite Kate Bush record. The answer to this and similar soundproofing problems is primitive but effective. And because many of the materials involved, timber, plasterboard and strips of mineral fibre sound and heating insulation, are relatively inexpensive, the highest price anyone is likely to pay is in floor space. Really good soundproofing will reduce the width of any room by up to about 170 centimetres, roughly 7 inches. But before you set off for the nearest builders' merchants, the government's building research establishment in Watford suggests a few preliminary checks to establish exactly where the noise is coming from. It could be entering through concealed holes in the wall where floor joists are shared and pipes run between dwellings, or even through electric sockets where two are installed back to back. Remember to switch the power off at the mains before looking. Then you have to be sure you have the correct wall, If the offending neighbours are directly above you, the bulk of their noise may not be coming through the ceiling, but along flanking paths in the hollow cavities between a plasterboard wall and the outside wall. If you live in an old terraced house, you may discover that the party wall stops at the upstairs ceiling height and that the loft space is shared. In other words, listen carefully and have a good look around before you do anything. Because unwanted sound creates vibrations that radiates through walls and floors, the source of the sound needs to be isolated. This is achieved by constructing a timber box frame containing sound-absorbent material and plenty of air. The first thing to do is carefully remove the skirting board so that you can reuse it later. Rockwool Limited of Mid Glamorgan produces a range of soundproofing materials, including an acoustic blanket that looks rather like a bed quilt, but instead of duck down, it contains spun rock within a glass fabric bag and costs about £2 a square metre. Using battens, hang this from the top of the wall. Against this, affix 75mm by 50mm timber plates to the floor and ceiling, and between these, vertical timber studding, about 400mm apart. Finally, using 30mm and special 50mm plasterboard screws, respectively, fit two layers of 7.5mm plasterboard. These should be staggered so that the edges do not coincide and overlap. You should use tapered edge plasterboard. If you cannot gain access to the upstairs flat where insulation blocks should be placed between the joists under the floorboards, the same technique is used for ceilings. Here, however, the weight of the timber frame will need to be carried on metal wall plates. In flats where floor space may be at a premium, an alternative to using an acoustic quilt and a frame is to remove the existing plasterboard and fit semi-rigid blocks that can be cut to size with a sharp knife. It may not eliminate the noise totally, but it will flatten the sound of footsteps and of doors opening and closing. The important thing to remember is that you need an airspace to isolate and kill the sound. That was by Jonathan Futrell, and there's a soundproofing booklet which costs £2, and that's available from the Building Research Establishment, Garston, Watford, WD2 7JR.
We've had quite a few publications through our letterbox this week. The first to mention is On Target, which is a brief note from Radio Netherlands. And from that, I'll remind you to listen to Media Network. Jonathan Marks hosts this weekly award-winning survey of communication developments compiled with the assistance of 190 monitors across the globe. And you can hear that in Europe on 12:30 UTC on 9855 kHz. They've brought back the service to Europe by popular demand. 12:30 UTC, 9855 kHz for Media Network from Radio Netherlands. And a letter now from Clive Collier, who's in Market Harborough in Leicestershire. Your broadcast was received on an old Stromberg Carlson valve set. I've recently moved the grand old lady of World War II whilst home renovations are completed to a temporary place of operation. There I'm using a 2 meter length of wire for an antenna and is operating well. Sparks is an excellent program with lots of interesting information. I look forward to hearing your programs again. Well, we look forward to having another letter from you. He sent a little sort of photocopied picture of the market hall in Market Harborough Marketplace in the heart of the English Midlands countryside. That's Clive Collier listening in. And here's a letter from someone in Dublin who doesn't want his name read out because he's involved in radio over there. I only recently discovered Radio Facts about 3 weeks ago and can say I find it very interesting. It's one of the very few solid information sources about free radio and radio in general that I've heard in quite some time. I listen to you on 6205 kHz on a Sony ICF-7600D using its own telescopic antenna. Reception is very good. And if you listen on a Sony ICF-7600D, listen out next week because there's a review of a pamphlet book that can help you get the best out of that radio. Radio here in Ireland has become very slow and boring ever since the demise of the super pirates of the late 80s, particularly in Dublin, where, even though we have a greater city population of over 1 million people, we have no more than 2 legitimate independent stations. They provide a very bland back-to-back music format which rarely differs between the two. A number of small pirates are in operation in Dublin, usually with a very heavy rave music format. Keep up the excellent work on your radio show. I hope to hear a lot more of it. That's someone writing from Dublin.
The Philips DC777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard-size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
Bad DJ, playing bad DJ, all the way back.
Recently, a station calling itself Veronica AM has been heard in the London area on 1395 kHz. Here's a snippet, with apologies for the poor reception, which demonstrates just how weak it was.
Yeah, it's quite a powerful statement there from Theo. Rock and roll children. We're listening to Veronica AM on 1395 kHz in the medium wave band. And telephone number is 081-443-1191. 081-443-1191. It's over the carriage. And explore some of those Peruvian walkways with good living. It's okay, but carry more.
That's Veronica AM coming from North London on 1395, and very weak indeed. A couple of short items from Electronics Weekly. Bus passengers in London will be better informed later this year when London Transport introduces a new electronic passenger information service at bus stops in the capital. The first pilot system, to be installed at 50 bus stops between King's Cross and Sudbury, will be supplied by Doughty Sonar and Communications in partnership with French traffic specialist Cerel. Microwave beacons operating at 23 gigahertz along the route will determine the position of buses to an accuracy of 10 meters. The position of each bus is fed into a central computer using radio links. Arrival time information is transmitted to bus stop displays using leased telephone lines. That's bound to put the bus fares up a bit, but it would be useful to know how long you've got to wait until your bus arrives. And Apple Computer has been rocked by a major setback in its $5.5 billion lawsuit against Microsoft and Hewlett-Packard. A California judge has ruled that most of the visual elements in the Macintosh user interface, such as graphical icons, are not protected by copyright. Apple said this copyright was violated by Microsoft's Windows and Hewlett-Packard's New Wave software. Jubilant attorneys for the two companies claimed an almost total victory. Judge Vaughn Walker will hold an additional hearing in early May to decide if the remaining legal issues should be decided at a trial. These include the right to use certain symbols like Apple's trash can for clearing a screen, and whether the HP and Microsoft programs are similar to Apple's in a way which infringes copyright. Legal experts hold out little hope for Apple, although the company's general counsel, Edward White, is hopeful that the court will send the issue to a jury for a decision. Apple is considering an appeal against the judge's ruling. That's Apple attempting to copyright their window, mouse and icon graphical user interface, which is strange because they stole it off the rank Xerox Corporation themselves, who designed this from original research in the late 1970s at their research labs in Palo Alto. Rank Xerox invented the graphical user interface, and it hasn't made them the millions it's made Apple. Still, that's the strange world of computers for you.
Plenty to chew over. How will the BBC shape up to the future? Asks Raymond Snoddy in the Financial Times. BBC governors and top management will start arriving at Lucknam Park, a secluded country house hotel in the Cotswolds, just before lunch on May the 20th. There they will enjoy good food and wine, stroll on the rolling lawns, join BBC chairman Marmaduke Hussey around the swimming pool and talk about the future of the corporation. It is probably the most important conference on the BBC they will ever attend. Their task is to reach agreement on its future structure, role and strategy in an age of multi-channel television. Ironically, Lucknum Park was where the top secret talks that led to the merger of satellite broadcasters BSB and Sky Television in November 1990 were held, thus creating one of the longer-term threats facing the BBC. Had the Labour Party won the general election on April the 9th, the debate over the corporation's future would not perhaps have reached its present intensity. Though a Labour government might have created funding problems with its uncosted manifesto commitments to concessionary licence fees for pensioners, there was a feeling inside the BBC that it had an emotional commitment to public service broadcasting. The Tories are perceived as far more likely to pull the BBC up by its roots. It is David Mellor, at the head of the National Heritage Department, who will handle the delicate negotiations for a new royal charter for the BBC to replace the one that runs out in 1996. In some respects, he is a lucky choice for the corporation. In 1990, during his second stint as broadcasting minister, Mr. Mellor effectively put his career on the line by supporting a strengthening of the quality commitments for ITV companies bidding in the competitive tenders for franchises. The change of emphasis from highest bids to quality had not been cleared with the then Prime Minister, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. In preparing a consultative document on the corporation's future for publication later this year, Mr. Mellor can be expected to be rigorous but open-minded. The government cannot be expected to solve any of the corporation's problems, however, problems being experienced by most public service broadcasters across Europe. As the number of television channels available through cable and satellite networks increases and the competition intensifies for both finance and audiences, all public service broadcasters face tough choices. Mr. Gerard Lafebvre, until recently Director of Strategy at CLT, the Luxembourg-based broadcaster, believes that by the end of the decade in most European countries, there will only be room for one national public service channel with one or two competing pay channels, up to three private general interest channels, and a growing number of specialist satellite channels. For the BBC, this scenario poses several basic questions. Can the corporation retain a reasonable share of the audience? Will Wyatt, managing director of BBC Network Television, has bravely identified his minimum target. From 1992 to 93, BBC One and BBC Two should be watched for a minimum of 2 hours each week by at least 90% of television households. If the BBC audience does melt away, how long can the imposition of a universal license fee be justified? And should the corporation therefore be financed partly by subscription or advertising? Should the BBC refine its public service role and concentrate on worthy programmes that the marketplace is unlikely to provide? The BBC's attempts to answer some of these questions took on a farcical aspect recently. No fewer than 15 task forces have been set up, each one looking at a particular facet of the organisation. Inevitably, they have come up with hundreds of proposals, ranging from the inspired to the bizarre. Privatise the BBC orchestras, farm out the morning hours to an outside producer, contract out so many services that 10,000 jobs will be lost over 5 years. Turn BBC Education into a public company. It was equally inevitable that the confidential proposals should leak out. BECTU, the main broadcasting union, handed out copies of the summaries of all 15 confidential reports, along with copies of the Funding Bible, the combined reports of consultants on possible methods of funding. This document included a chart showing the revenue that would accrue from 2 minutes an hour of advertising. BECTU officials quickly denounced the BBC for secretly planning to introduce advertising, even though the chart indicated that it would be difficult for the BBC to take adverts without damaging ITV. Other areas, such as privatising orchestras, have been publicly repudiated by Sir Michael Checkland, the BBC Director General, before they have been formally considered. As the task forces were letting their minds roam over potential reforms, a market-oriented policy known as producer choice was being introduced by the corporation. Under it, producers will be able to hire camera crews, makeup artists, and by next year, studios outside the BBC if they are cheaper. The policy is designed to bring competition to an organisation accused by its critics of waste and inefficiency. Some staff say that chaos, poor morale, and large-scale redundancies are the more likely outcome. Mr. Tony Lennon, joint president of BEC2, says that in some areas BBC staff would be unable to compete with outsiders even if they worked for free because of the high cost of their overheads. The BBC has set up a committee to look into overheads, and managerial redundancies would almost certainly result. Absolute gloom is how one old BBC hand described the present mood. There is clearly tension between the Conservatives, who probably could make up most of the staff, and the Radicals, who take their cue from Marmaduke Hussey, and Mr. John Burt, the Deputy Director General, who takes over the top job on March the 1st next year. Sir Michael is unlikely to be approaching the need for change with the same gusto as John Burt. All the signs of the self-examination process are that what is being contemplated is a redefining of the BBC's role rather than a radical transformation. A modest move upmarket away from the expected tough competition between ITV and satellite television. To continue justifying a universal licence fee, the BBC will broadcast all kinds of programmes. BBC comedy might, for example, be more Victoria Wood than Les Dawson. Radio 1 would still broadcast music aimed at young people, but would leave the hit parade more to the growing commercial sector. Whether the BBC can be successfully repositioned without alienating its staff and confusing its audience is open to question. Even before its governors and managers get to the final lunch of their Lucknam Park conference on Friday, May the 22nd, they will already have had plenty to chew on. Raymond Snoddy there, looking at the future of the BBC, with the charter renewal coming up in 1996, writing in the Financial Times.
Listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. And in case you're wondering, that's a Ukrainian folk song about Verkhovnia, an area of special beauty in the hills and highlands of the Carpathian Mountains. The waters are flowing and there is freshness and freedom in the air. A man stands with a musket in his hand and an axe in his right, and he is in love with a girl with beautiful goose-white skin. In the distance, someone is playing the sipilika, and there are faint sounds of a wedding. This is a very popular song in Ukraine, and I'll play that for Leonid Dezinov, who's listening in Ukraine, Kiev 22 to be exact. And incidentally, it's a common error to refer to Ukraine as the Ukraine. This is grammatically incorrect, similar to saying the England, and is a linguistic ploy first used by an 18th century Tsar in order to lower the status of Ukraine within his empire. So, Leonid Dezivnov is listening on a P25OM2 communications with a long wire antenna 5 meters long, and he listens on 6205, and thanks for the report, which is correct, and he wishes us good transmitting. Well, good listening back to Leonid in Ukraine. And a letter from David Tyler, who's in Eastern Bristol. It's great to be writing to you, as I've been listening to you on and off for a number of years. I'm 42 years old, I'm blind, and I work as a self-employed piano tuner. Shortwave listening and also amateur radio have been keen interests of mine since my early teens. As a person without access to the printed word, I find the Sparks program of particular interest. I receive your programs best on 6205, although late at night 3910 is the clearest signal. I've never had 12255, however. Being a trusting individual, I'll take your word for it that you're really there. When I started this letter, I said it was great to be writing to you, the reason for that being that I've recently acquired a talking word processor, which has made the business of letter writing much easier. The receiver I have is an old Sony ICF-7600D. When the set came to me, it had about 2 inches of antenna left. However, a piece of coat hanger now serves as a perfectly good replacement, and I've found that putting longer antennas on it only serves to increase overloading. I wish you all the best for the future, and I look forward to you becoming a legally authorised broadcaster. That's my sort of aerial, I think. Being listened to on an ICF-7600D, David Tyler, someone else who can listen next week for some simple improvements to get better performance from your 7600. And I'll have another letter, why not? This is Mr. M.B. Evans in Loughton Way, Essex. First off, I thank you for the plug regarding the making of medium-wave loop aerials. I had 18 letters, out of which there has been 12 sales. It's been the main reason I've not wrote before to thank you. If upon reading this letter on air you'd care to state just what a medium-wave loop is, maybe some of your other Sparks fanatics will write in. Well, a medium-wave loop aerial, you can make one yourself if you don't want to buy Mr. Evans, is a loop of, you make a cross out of 2 bits of wood about 18 inches long each, you make them into a cross, and you wind about 10 turns of wire around them, and you connect each end to a 500 picofarad capacitor out of an old radio. And if you play around with it, or you can use an inductance formula to calculate the right number of turns, you can tune it to various frequencies on the medium wave band and long wave if you can be bothered. And so you put your radio inside the thing and you tune the loop aerial, and it will peak on the particular frequency you're listening to if you've made it right, and it gives very strong reception and is ideal for listening to other independent stations or BBC stations around the country, or attempting to listen to Irish stations. I heard the old pirate Kiss FM, not Kiss FM, Kiss AM, in, I think it was from the north of Ireland, on 1008 kilohertz. Let me think. Yes, I think that was about 3 or 4 years ago, before the Irish legislation. So they definitely work very well. I've made one myself. However, Mr. Evans is selling them, and they seem good value indeed as well. And you can write to him at 120 Loughton Way, Essex, IG6 6AR. That's Mr. M.B. Evans, 120 Loughton Way, Essex, IG 6 9 That's IG96AR. And Mr. Evans also says he has a load of magazines about radio and TV for sale. If you send him a stamped addressed envelope, he'll do you a list.
In The Independent, there's been some correspondence to the editor about the price of compact discs. European Commission ruling could end price abuse over compact discs is the headline. Dear Sir, the Office of Fair Trading's finding that retailers are taking advantage of customers by selling CDs for about 50% more than LPs or cassettes may be the first step towards an eventual ruling by the European Commission that certain companies are abusing positions of dominance, which they may enjoy over the relevant consumer market. I would like to inform Elizabeth Murby that if the Commission finds that the selling prices imposed by dominant retailers are, quote, unfair, then under Article 86A of the EEC Treaty 1957, their actions would amount to an abuse of a dominant position and would thus be illegal. A lot depends, of course, upon the construction of what is unfair. However, a product's utility would certainly not be considered. Rather, the average costs of acquiring the products from the copyright owners and manufacturers of the CDs in question. If deemed unfair, such behaviour can only illustrate an abuse of the free market, not a mere fact of normal economic behaviour. Yours faithfully, C. Burton from Leicester.
The managing director of Tower Records' European operation accuses others of muddying the water and then proceeds to confuse things still further. The fact is that compact discs in the United States cost a fraction of the price charged in Britain, and nothing said by Mr. Sokolov justifies the difference. Last week in Boston, I purchased a two-disc set for $15.74, including sales tax. That's £9.15 at today's exchange rate, and would only be £10.44 at the most unfavourable rate cited in his letter. The price in British shops is £25.99, or $44.70 at today's exchange rate. That was a CD paid for in Boston at $15. The discs I bought have a sticker on the packaging stating CD made in Austria, packaged in the Netherlands. Evidently, Americans are able to underwrite the allegedly higher costs in Europe and still offer low prices. How, by the way, can companies justify charging the same price for CDs, which simply transfer recordings from vinyl discs? The overheads have already been paid. Can it really be argued that UK customers are not being ripped off? At the current low tariffs for transatlantic flights, a trip could almost be paid for out of the savings on CD purchases. That's LD Johnston in Labanus in Powys in Wales.
Dear Sir, quite apart from the fruitless discussions on the pricing of CDs, which is demand-led and reflects the fact that you generally get about 65 minutes of glitch-free music for about £12.50 instead of 40 damage-prone minutes for £9, are we not merely seeing the usual anti-technology reactions of the little vinylists, who probably wrote almost identical letters to the press about the demise of 78 RPM, the 10-inch LP, the introduction of stereo, the adoption of hi-fi separates, instead of the radiogram disguised as a sideboard, or vice versa, and the use of Dolby, etc. Yes, it sure was fun setting up a record deck using little counterweights, strobe discs, anti-static mats, and a variety of mostly useless record cleaning devices, but I, for one, and I am pushing 50, not only welcome the quality and facilities provided by a CD system, but am also fully prepared to accept a further improvement within my lifetime that will make the CD seem as antique as the aforementioned gizmos are today. Yours sincerely, Klaus Bogstad from Richmond in Surrey.
Sir, dear sir, what Elizabeth Murby neglected to mention regarding the utility value of CDs was the utility gained by a short search period. Nowadays, the major music retailers devote much of their space to CDs. To offset the disutility of high price is the utility gained from ease of purchase. The opposite is now the case with vinyl. The utility gained from a lower price is offset by the need to go to more specialised shops. The market may not be failing, but the consumers are, although hotly denied by the retailers, being pushed out of the vinyl market and into the CD market. That's Preston Capes writing from Clipston in Leicestershire to The Independent. Well, yes, maybe you do get more for your money from compact discs as compared to LPs, but they currently cost less to produce than them. And presume that that's just the cost of the discs, and presumably the printing and packaging costs less as well because there's less size of it. They also cost less to transport, and probably cost less in returns as well because they're generally more reliable, which is why so many of the retailers have sprung to selling them. So, you may get more, but they cost less. However, price equality will probably mean the price of LPs going up to the price of CDs, not the other way around. This week on Sparks, we review the first edition of The Wave, a new underground radio magazine, details of a new space mission to probe Venus, listen to a new FM pirate that isn't a pirate, goings on in the AM band in the London area, fed up to the back teeth with the neighbours, well, why not fit some DIY sound insulation, an extract and review of the new radio tape next. From the Radio Broadcast Library, the government continue to pile the pressure on the BBC, what services will be squeezed out, and consumers speak out about outrageous prices for compact discs. Out now is the latest edition of The Radio Tape, a magazine programme produced by the Radio Broadcast Library. Here's a quick extract.
Welcome to edition 4 of the Radio Tape. In a packed tape this month, we talk to Trevor Brooks, the station manager of Radio Facts, the unique Irish-based shortwave station. We also talk to a couple of veterans from the world of offshore radio, Nigel Harris and Martin Kane, who tell us about two distinct periods of offshore radio history. All that, along with the usual features, is coming your way in the next 90 minutes on the Radio Tape. Kicking us off, as usual, here's...
That's how issue 4 of the Radio Tape, a new monthly roundup of radio news and gossip, starts. Also included is an interview with someone from the new satellite radio station Solar Radio, including some gossip that they've been ticked off by the radio authority for promoting shortwave pirate radio stations. Naughty, naughty, and they lost their licence for a few days. The programme also includes Radio Caroline news, including an extract of an interview with Peter Moore on another satellite radio station, Quality Europe FM, and part of the Caroline broadcast from the QEFM transponder, as part of a possible Caroline service from the Astra satellite. They also report the opening of Quality Bay 603 with a kilowatt in the medium wave band from Barrow in Furness. They will produce 3 hours of local programming interspersed with 21 hours relaying QEFM. They also play extracts from the BBC 40 Minutes programme about Radio Luxembourg and Media Network, reporting the withdrawal and reinstation of their European service. The tape also includes an interview with Trevor about Radio Facts. Nothing new here for you if you're hearing this. There's also an interview with Nigel Harris from Radio Caroline, focusing on his early memories of life on the Mi Amigo. I'd rather have heard him talking about his more recent experiences. However, here's an extract from that.
Now on the Radio Tape, Tim Stewart talks to a former offshore broadcaster who has just begun a new career on land. Nigel Harris's radio career began back in 1976 on board the Mi Amigo. In those days, he was Stuart Russell.
Well, we're going to talk about the early days of your career in broadcasting. I think you actually went under a different name in those days, weren't you?
That's right. It all started as Stuart Russell many, many moons ago when I first went to Radio Caroline when it was on the Mi Amigo. And I'd listened to the station on and off, as we all used to, for quite a long time. And I was about two or three years out of school. I was working in London at the Central Office of Information in the Civil Service, which was very boring, commuting to town every day from Sittingbourne, leaving at the crack of dawn, getting back about midnight, and I thought, this is really, really naff. And I thought it would be really great fun to get on the radio, and I'd played around with tapes and records in the bedroom, as we all used to do when we were younger. But I didn't know how to get in touch with Caroline at all, because in those days, unlike more recent years, it was totally, totally secret. So I wrote to an anorak magazine, the name of which I can't remember now, but I wrote to them and said, could you please pass this letter on to Ronan O'Reilly? And about two or three weeks later, a letter comes back and says, thank you for your letter. What would you like to do? Would you like to go on the air? Would you like to be a deckhand? So I wrote back and said, please, may I go on the air? Thank you. About a week later, the phone rang, and it was a lady called Una, who was the station manager in those days, and she invited me up for an interview, told me to bring a tape with me. So I went up to London and met Una, and Mark Lawrence was there at the same time in the office, and we sat through my tape, which was appalling, if I can be honest about it, and I thought, there's no chance I'll get a job out of this. And Mark interviewed me, Una interviewed me, asked me what I was doing at the time. And I was sent away, and they asked me for another tape, so I thought, well, that's really it, I'll never hear another thing about this. But even before I got round to making another tape, I got another phone call asking if I could go that following weekend. And so I went back up to London, went through the preliminaries, picked up all the records and tapes we were supposed to be using, and on the Saturday morning, took the ferry from Dover across to France, booked into a hotel, because then the weather decided to get bad, so we didn't actually go anywhere for about another week. And I was due to meet Tony Allen over in Boulogne, and I'd never met the guy before, but heard a lot about him, and I saw him standing in the reception area of the hotel. I was very shy and insecure, so I didn't actually run up to him and introduce myself. I peeped round corners and thought, oh my goodness, it's Tony Allen. And it's about 3 days, actually, before we bumped into each other, and we were both looking for the skipper of the fishing boat down on the jetty, and got on the boat. It was about 8 days later, actually, after the weather had subsided somewhat, and we went out to the ship, and it took about 18 hours in a small fishing boat from Boulogne, which sounds appalling, but that's as long as it took. And we got out there, and it was a joy to behold, first time seeing a pirate radio station. We pulled up alongside. On board at the time was, let me think now, Kelvin. I think he was calling himself James Ross at the time. That's Kelvin O'Shea.
That's part of an interview with Nigel Harris on the radio tape. Next on the radio tape, it's right back to the 60s, and Martin Kane talks about Radio Essex, Radio 227, and Radio 355. I couldn't help smiling listening to their talkover tracks, including a naff synthesised jazz funk version of Thus Sprach Zarathustra, the 2001 film theme. You know how it goes. 0 out of 10 for cred there, lads, I think. If you're interested in satellite radio, then this is definitely the tape for you, as about a third of the 90-minute long tape is devoted to this subject. However, I didn't find these parts of the programme particularly interesting. I also find so much radio news a bit of a brain overload all in one go, but this obviously is the information you want to hear if you pay the money for the radio tape. It's professionally recorded, and unnecessary waffle is kept to a minimum in the interviews, apart from the one with Martin Kane, which dragged on a bit. You can order a copy of the radio tape from the Radio Broadcast Library at P.O. Box 145, Dover, in Kent, CT17 0YX, in England. Individual copies cost £3.90, or you can order 12 issues, or a year's subscription for £35. Make cheques payable to RBL, that's the Radio Broadcast Library, P.O. Box 145, Dover, in Kent, CT17 0YX, in England. Also write and ask them for a catalogue of their classic archive radio recordings, videos and photographs. RBL also sell new and used satellite equipment at reasonable prices, and a useful gadget that will decode a second sound subcarrier in parallel to the one in the satellite receiver. This is intended to allow you to listen to satellite radio whilst the rest of the family rot their brains watching satellite television. Presumably this box will also turn a mono satellite receiver into a stereo one by picking up the other sound channel. That's the radio tape, which is interesting, and I'll look forward to reviewing some more in the future. And also, don't forget you can call the Inferno Hotline, produced by the Radio Caroline staff on board the Ross Revenge. Dial 0836 404 575. Calls cost 45p a minute peak and 36p a minute at all other times. That's the Inferno Hotline on 0836 404 575.
96% of advertising is wasted, reports Winston Fletcher. As almost everyone knows, advertising is in the doldrums. It isn't just the recession. Advertising started to plummet early in 1989, well before the recession really began to bite. Advertising's problems are more fundamental, and the decline is worldwide. The unhappy truth is that advertising has failed to keep up with the pace of economic change. Advertisers like to think in terms of mass markets and mass media. But as brands and media have proliferated, target markets have fragmented. Even campaigns for major brands ought to be targeted at minority audiences, but they rarely are. That is the principal way in which advertising has gone astray. Think about your own shopping habits. If you visit a supermarket, you may leave with 30, 40 or perhaps 50 items listed on your checkout bill. The average number of items of all kinds purchased per visit is about 20. Many of these will not be advertised brands. Some others will be multiple purchases of the same brand. At a maximum, you will have bought a handful of advertised brands from the 15,000 lines on sale in the store. Over a year, you are unlikely to buy more than a few hundred different brands. Consumer durables, perhaps a dozen a year. Cars, if yours is a new car, the statistical likelihood is that it is supplied by your employer. If it isn't, you only buy one every 3 years. And though it may seem otherwise, you do not buy that many clothes either. and most of them will not be advertised brands. Even when you throw in confectionery, medicines, hardware, all the services you can think of, it is virtually certain that you do not buy more than 400 different brands a year. Compare that figure with the 32,500 branded goods and services that, according to Media Register, are advertised. Let's ignore the 23,000 which spend less than £50,000 a year and concentrate on the 9,500 brands that Media Register individually lists and analyses. Mr. and Mrs. Average have bought 400 of that 9,500, and not all because of their advertising. That's about 4%. So you can forget that naive maxim usually attributed to Lord Leverhulme, half of my advertising is wasted, but I've no way of knowing which half. You could say that 96% of all advertising is wasted, but nobody knows which 96%. When you're watching TV tonight, count how many of the commercials are for brands you buy or are likely to buy in the future. For most people, the figure seems to be about 1 in 16, 6%. So the commercials for the other 15, 94% are, on the face of it, wasted. You probably think you're a special case, that you are impervious to advertising. Almost everyone thinks the same, but you aren't, and they aren't. The truth is, nobody buys most of the brands they see advertised. Waste is inherent in the use of media for advertising. The notion that every reader of a publication or every viewer of a commercial break might immediately rush out and buy all or even many of the brands advertised is ludicrous. People register only a tiny number of the advertisements they see and ignore the rest. So waste cannot be avoided. That does not mean advertising isn't cost-effective. Millions of advertisements have proved it is. Advertising has to communicate with large numbers of people to reach the relevant minority, because the advertiser cannot know in advance exactly which individuals will respond to his blandishments. Media advertising works despite its much publicised expense, because it is a cheap means of mass communication. Nonetheless, all waste is gruesome. With smart targeting, the advertiser can minimise the wastage by increasing the percentage of readers or viewers who will respond. But he can never know precisely who will respond. Even the most accurate and finely tuned direct mail shot never achieves 100% response. This is one of the fundamental differences between the use of media and face-to-face selling. It is possible just to envisage a salesman scoring with every prospect he speaks to. The same could never happen when media are used. If the advertiser knew exactly which people were going to respond, there would be no point in using media at all. The advertiser could communicate with them directly. This is as true of birth, marriage, and death notices as it is of Coca-Cola commercials. Any advertiser who can net 1 million new customers, 2% of the adult population, is doing well. Persil and Ariel, the two top-selling brands in supermarkets, would be delighted with a million extra regular customers. So that any advertising campaign for any product, or any political party for that matter, which could win over 2% of the population, would be outstandingly successful. And that, as I began by saying, is but a tiny minority of the population. The most cost-effective way to reach them may be the use of mass media. But if advertising is to get going again, its message will need to be more tightly targeted than ever before. That was Winston Fletcher writing, and he's the author of a new book called From a Glittering Haze, published by NTC Publications at £12.95, all about the world of advertising.
Yes. This is a test transmission from Pirate FM 102. Pirate FM 102 is the on-air name of a brand new radio service to be provided by Cornwall Independent Radio Limited, holder of the new Radio Authority licence for this area. Pirate FM 102 plans to commence broadcasting at 10 to 8 in the morning on Friday the 3rd of April 1992. This new service can be heard on 102.8 FM in West Cornwall and 102.2 FM in East Cornwall and parts of West Devon. This is a test transmission from Pirate FM 102.
From the Tamar's bridges down to Land's End, there's a place of sea and sun. Hiding history, Merlin's wizardry, and surfers having fun.
It's romantic.
Cathedral spires and Truro's heart, Budman Moor and St. Michael's Mount. Fishing and farming, tourists too, they're industries that count.
Cornwall.
The future's looking great. Great Britain's Western Gate, where we share traditions old and new.
With you,
we've got the spirit, and it shows in everything we do. We're serving Cornwall and West Devon too.
Excuse me while I puke up.
Good morning, it's 9 minutes to eight. I'm Roger Day. It's taken many years, but now, at last, Cornwall and West Devon has Pirate FM, the world's newest radio station, and probably the best.
I love the colourful clothes you wear, and the way the sun...
To 8, the new Pirate FM 102. Now a legendary land has a legendary radio station, and oh yes, we do play the best music. The new Pirate FM, 2 minutes to 8 o'clock. Lots of time checks on the breakfast show, of course. Some people actually want to get up, believe it or not. I actually woke up at 3 o'clock, couldn't get back to sleep again. What a silly old boy he is. Anyway, the new Pirate FM, this is Roger Day, the first man here, Duncan Warren's warm-up person, if the truth be known. If you want to contact us, we are at the Carnbrae Studios, Wilson Way, Redruth, TR15 3XX. And oh yes, we are very approachable.
Finally, the legend has come alive. Today we witness the birth of the Pirate, and Brian's of St. Austell and Weybridge, your local Vauxhall main dealers, are delighted to be the first to welcome our new station to the airwaves. As the first advertiser, we wish all the crew of the Pirate many successes.
Yeah.
There's a variety, more music, the new Pirate.
Yes, recognisable ILR, NAF, sung jingles, and mention the name of the station every link, etc, etc. That was Roger Day, who was recently kicked out of Invicta Radio in their shake-up. He's the new programme controller. Thanks to George Williams for sending us a copy of that tape, and also their free newspaper. And flicking through it, I notice someone I used to work for at County Sound. It's Richard Lawley, who used to be the chief engineer at County Sound in Guildford. He's obviously been given the push by John O'Monier, or did he leave because he couldn't bear to work with him? He's the operations controller down at Pirate FM, and also a programme dumped by County Sound. The classic programme by Bob Symes is being relayed down on Pirate FM. So flicking through that, it's a free newspaper and normally sort of stuff, win a car, you know, blah blah promotional stuff, and we'll have his bit of George's letter. I think all local radio is crap, really. Remember, I didn't say that. It's George Williams you want to address your complaints to. I enclose a tape of the new radio station, Pirate FM. The start has gaps because of an error by the presenter. I hope you'll understand the new technology took a bit of getting used to. It's no longer the case they insert all sorts like laughter, clapping, comments, etc. I still wonder how it's being done, as they use no tapes or records, just CDs. Well, it's probably a big CD jukebox with them all stored in there. Their studio is in what's called a beehive unit, which was constructed by Kerrier District Council a long time ago on an industrial estate for any business which wished to rent one of the units, presumably. We have a government with more of the same. I had a book about who was to blame for the Marine etc. Broadcast Offences Act. It was called Broadcasting from the High Seas by Paul Harris. I borrowed it from our local library after they did a computer search, and there wasn't one in Cornwall. They tell how the Tories were at Wedgwood Ben's throat to be more forceful. I'm no admirer of Mr. Ben, but I'm a Labour supporter, despite the rough ride we gave the Wilson government. Tories have done nothing for you and won't. I was hopeful that Mark Fisher, Labour spokesman for the arts and media, would listen to me, but the Tories have dashed it. I was to appeal personally for a licence, as I admire Radio Facts. I'm 61 and I know a lot more about politics. I had several awards for my efforts writing to the press. No one has fought for Caroline more than I have. She's very dear to me. Well, thanks, George Williams, writing from Redruth in Cornwall. And thanks for the NAF tape of Pirate FM, the new start-up down there. Independent local radio, classic style, in Cornwall. Out now is the first issue of a new underground magazine full of radio news and gossip, The Wave. And it leads with the apt headline, The Legend Limps On, talking about Caroline transmissions in Dover, which are reported as giving poor coverage outside the centre of Dover. With 25 watts from high ground, they should be able to do much better than that. Two of the six pages are dedicated to satellite radio, and a very dodgy internal mod that VideoCrypt decoder users can do to prevent their card being zapped, presumably to allow you to continue using the decoder after the card expires. But this wasn't made 100% clear. In character for the first issue of a magazine, it includes some made-up readers' letters, including one from the legendary and now retired DTI official Eric Gotts. We got a mention, but we're on 12255, not 12225 as they report. There are some TV programme reviews. The magazine is produced on a grotty desktop publishing package. The digitised photographs are not very clear, but it's all I should expect from a no-budget underground magazine. So, in common with the radio tape, much of the contents features satellite radio, which starts me yawning, but the information is good and up to date. So, I welcome this new addition to Radio Anorak magazines, much appreciated since the sad folding of Anorak's UK. If you'd like a copy of The Wave, then I'm sure they'll send you one. Write to The Wave, care of 51 St Mark's Road, Canvey Island, Essex, SS89NJ in England. There's no set charge for the magazine, but they ask for a donation to help cover costs. That's The Wave, from care of 51 St Mark's Road, Canvey Island, Essex, SS89NJ in England. Mr. Marker writes to us from Priestwood in Bracknell, Berkshire, somewhere I was a couple of days ago, at the Hewlett-Packard buildings. I was listening to your station on the 14th of April. I did like your programme, and I have a radio Trio 9R59DS with a long wire 40 metres long. He's also got a Sangean ATS-803 like myself. If anyone would like to know information of how to build an ATU, he's prepared to send it to people. If you send letters via us, if you say, attention of Mr. Marker, care of Sparks, and the address is Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. I'll pass the messages on with details of how to build an aerial tuning unit. It looks like quite a reasonable one. And that's the address for any comments about the programmes. Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And any letter will get a mention on air, as I'm doing with these. And if you'd like a reply in writing, with a station card, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, with technical details, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. And Phil Bond writes to us from Beverley in East Yorkshire. Hello, I've just listened to your show for the first time, and I was very impressed with the content. Reception was usually good, but broke up to unintelligible on odd occasions, notably when you gave your postcode out. Are you sure you're not trying to be secretive? I like the piece on digital audio tape and its copy code lock troubles. Seems to me that the techno-mad Japanese and the paranoid recording industry deserve each other wholesale. Do you remember the sticker the music industry produced some years ago? Home taping is killing music? Well, yes. How about £20 a ticket is killing live music? And Trevor remembers a music business magazine having a feature, Home Taping is Skill in Music. Anyway, I digress. Being an avid shortwave listener, I thought a day off work ill with a head cold would give me time to tune around the dial. Not so. Credit to you, I heard your tape right through. He's listening on a Tatong TMR7602 with a 13-metre long wire through an ATU and an amplifier. Do you transmit at night? Yes, we're 24 hours apart from on 3910, which is only on during night. That's for when he returns to work. Thanks for the letter, Phil Bond, who's listening in Beverley in East Yorkshire. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax.
I want to.
thanks to someone for sending in the Journal of the Association of Italian Amateur Sound Recordists, which, unfortunately, is in Italian, so it's pretty useless to me. Never mind. And also, Martin D sends in the Stour Valley Hospital Radio magazine, which has got a picture of him in it. He does the Friday evening programmes on Stour Valley Hospital Radio, so hello to everyone there. A report written by Lawrence Hallett now. World Market for Broadcast Transmission Systems to 1995. A report published by Elsevier Advanced Technology examines the world market for terrestrial broadcast transmission systems to 1995, intended to be primarily of interest to broadcasters, equipment manufacturers and investors. The 216-page dossier was compiled by UK consultancy company Hiltec Limited, which boasts personnel with considerable worldwide broadcast radio engineering experience. As one might expect from a publication costing £1,500, a great deal of comprehensive information is provided. An examination of the current state of broadcasting technology is included, together with a detailed list of major equipment suppliers, including contact information. Broadcasters are examined by region and by country, with outlines of known expansion plans included. A great deal of tabulated material is included in a market forecasts section. The report ends with an analysis and conclusions section, which also looks further ahead to the start of the next millennia. For those with an interest in television, similar information on this is also included. The report forecasts that overall the market will be virtually static. Growth of up to 1% is predicted by 1993, with a subsequent small decline. This trend is not universal, and the report further identifies key areas where potential for growth is evident. Three factors are highlighted in the report as having a profound long-term effect on the global market for internal and international broadcast transmission systems, namely development of the world economy, the recent dramatic changes in East-West relations, and the development of alternative delivery systems such as cable and satellite. At the end of last year, when this report was compiled, most observers considered that the economies of Western Europe, North America and Japan were suffering from recession. The report also takes a cautious attitude to the timing of an economic upturn, consequently forecasting that market stimulus for such a high investment will not act until the mid-1990s. Taking this scenario, market demand in Europe is expected to be static in the period to 1995, with declining demand in North America over the same period. Market growth is, however, predicted for Africa, Central and Southern America. Improved East-West relations are seen to have a mixed effect. Although internal services in Eastern Europe look set to expand, HF external services beamed to such areas may decline. Similarly, the competitive environment between East and West beaming their views to non-aligned nations may also decrease. The report was written before broadcasters and governments had experienced the recent upheavals in the Soviet Union, which proved the continuing importance of HF broadcasting. With this in mind, it's probable that the report may be unduly pessimistic about the future of such services. Alternative broadcasting technologies, both satellite and cable, are increasingly being used for broadcast transmission, as well as for program links and news gathering. Although these delivery systems are already having a dramatic effect on TV services, the report concludes that radio broadcasting will be little affected in the near future, except that specialist services may develop with such technology. Take heed, Radio Broadcast Library and the Wave magazines. Anyway, as a result of these factors, the report concludes that in the period to 1995, there will be a steady fall in demand for long-wave and HF transmission equipment. Medium-wave equipment, on the other hand, will continue to be attractive, particularly in developing countries, because of the simplicity and low cost of the technology involved. The bright spot indicated by the report is FM systems, predicted to expand at 8% per annum. this growth is seen as coming from a wide geographical spread of countries. Many countries are improving their internal services with new and additional FM stations and relay transmitters. In particular, Eastern Europe, and to a lesser extent the USSR, are likely to provide large potential markets as part of their drive to improve broadcasting infrastructures. However, the introduction of new equipment to those areas is likely to be slowed by a lack of finance and FM receivers. For manufacturers, the report indicated that the potential market is growing in developing countries such as India, China and the USSR, as was, particularly for companies providing equipment which can complement existing local production. The report forecasts that equipment prices will fall in real terms to the middle of the decade. Companies will have to fight to retain their market share as requirements decline, particularly for long-wave and HF systems. Although solid state design and improved efficiency is making transmitters smaller, it's not making them cheaper to produce in real terms. With such high levels of competition, there's a strong incentive for manufacturers to reduce their costs without compromising equipment specifications. Even in a report on such scale, detailed local information is difficult to include, but as an initial point of reference, the publication will doubtless prove useful. Well, if you've got a spare 1,500 quid, the broadcast transmission report is available for Elsevier Advanced Technology. The phone number in the UK is 0865 512 242. 0865 512 242. And that review was written by Lawrence Hallett from Phoenix Communications. Don't forget to visit the Sparks stand at the 9th National Amateur Radio Car Boot Sale at Stockwood Park in Luton, just off Junction 10 of the M1. Turn up and say you listen to Sparks on Radiofax, and I'll give you a pile of free electronic components, ICs, capacitors, diodes, etc. I'll look forward to meeting you there on Sunday the 17th of May at Stockwood Park, just off Junction 10 of the M1. It starts at 10 a.m. See you there. That's an excellent place to get a bargain.